What's in your kid's digital dossier? The potential dangers of sharenting. What was the first thing you posted on social media about your child? An ultrasound announcing a pregnancy? Maybe a photo of your toddler dumping a bowl of spaghetti on his head? Whatever it was, it left a digital footprint. Author and law professor Leah Plunkett wants us to think about what we share digitally. She warns that social media posts, when combined with other digital information, smart home info, cloud service records, might compromise your child's privacy, or worse, leave a digital record beyond your or their control. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Plunkett is our guest today to discuss her new book, Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk Online About Our Kids. Have you thought twice before hitting that publish button? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio Studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. To post or not to post? That's the question that many of us and many of our children may ask when thinking about what to put on their social media pages. And that question is just the tip of the iceberg when we start thinking about our children's digital footprint. Today, my guest is Leah Plunkett. She is author of the new book, Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. Leah is a professor at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law and a faculty member at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you post photos of your kids or grandkids online? If so, do you ever wonder what might become of these posts? Who owns them? And whether or not they might live on forever? Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Hi, Leah, and thank you so much for being here today.
Such a pleasure to be here.
So we're having this conversation during holiday season, and for decades, people have sent out holiday cards with kids' photos and even newsletters. So there is a tradition of sharing with circles that are maybe broader than your everyday circles this time of year. How is sharenting different than old-fashioned sharing of photos and newsletters?
Sharenting is different because of how far the information can travel. So when you're sending a good old-fashioned holiday card, which I still do myself, you are sending it to a defined group of people that you control. The odds of one of those folks taking the time to photocopy it and mail it around or even screenshot it and upload it, pretty small. So you have some control. Sharenting refers to all the ways that parents, as well as other trusted adults, transmit children's private information digitally. So you lose control of it because you cannot fully understand where it's going or how it may be used now or in the future, and it never really goes away. So most holiday cards, they might get saved for a little while. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll sort of make it onto someone's fridge, but you're going to wind up in the recycling bin, you know, by the time the new year rolls around. That's not true of the sharented information. It keeps going and going, Energizer Bunny style.
So in your view, what are the most dangerous things to sharent? You know, at the very top of the show, I mentioned that someone might share an ultrasound or someone might share a picture of their toddler dumping spaghetti on his head. Those are really not the same in terms of online peril, are they?
They are not. I think it is most dangerous when you are sharenting very intimate information. So very intimate information meaning anything medical, so an ultrasound picture, meaning anything that is potentially embarrassing now or in the future, or anything that really could be used sort of against your child. And what I mean by that last category would be an image that might show a child not fully clothed. And I'm referring to a perfectly innocent photo, so kid at the beach or kid in the bubble bath, but anything where you are documenting your child in any state of undress and putting that out there, I think is risky. So I agree with you. I think that ultrasound picture, since it contains a lot of intimate medical information, is more risky than the temper tantrum. The temper tantrum is potentially embarrassing, but not really revealing of identifying information.
And to get it clear, you're not advocating that people withdraw from the modern
world. Not at all.
And you personally have social media.
I do. I have social media. I have my phone. I recently had a breakup with my fitness tracking watch because I couldn't keep it charged, but I was really attached to that for a long time. It was the thing that got me motivated to get running again after having my second child. And anything, of course, that is a tracking device of any sort that's digital is picking up your personal information. So no, I really advocate that we continue to embrace living in a digital world and being connected by a digital world. But I encourage us to do exactly what we're doing now and what we're about to do with the listeners and have values-based, thoughtful conversations about how we want to structure the digital world, particularly for our kids.
Right, because part of what you're talking about here is a whole sense of privacy. Those of us who are adults, we make decisions. We decide whether to get a smart speaker for our home. We decide whether or not to be on Facebook and what to post. And part of your point is your kids don't have those privacy choices when they're under 18.
Exactly right. So we have a heightened obligation, certainly as parents, but also I would say as grandparents, teachers, coaches, directors, aunts, uncles, all the trusted adults in children's lives, we are making digital decisions for our kids. And there does come to be a point, of course, where kids have a sense of autonomy and agency and maybe grabbing a friend's device or even sneaking behind our backs and grabbing one of our devices. But certainly when our kids are too young to make any of their own choices, and even when they're old enough to know how to use a device, it's still our choice if we have it around. And there are many things that we do that until the child is 18, they really don't have any say over, legal or practical.
Walk us through some of the scenarios that concern you, things that you have seen happen because of information that's out there because of children, children's digital information being disseminated.
So the scenarios that worry me are the ones where you see a child's safety or sense of well-being being compromised sort of in real time, like something is happening to them that is harmful or even just unpleasant that would not be happening to them except for the digital sharing. And give a recent example that was, very much in the news the past few weeks were the Ring cameras that managed to be hacked into by outsiders. And so parents that were using what they were looking to have as an intra-home, so internal to their house, digital way of monitoring their kids, all of a sudden had strangers hacking in, breaching the security of the device, breaching the privacy of the home, and going in and speaking directly to children. That's very scary. And that would not have happened but for sharenting. Because, of course, sharenting is very much about social media, but not only about social media. Anytime you're transmitting a child's information digitally, that's sharenting. So that kind of in real time, in real life, breach of the privacy of the home because of sharenting really concerns me. I also get really concerned about ways that children's private information can be aggregated, analyzed, and acted upon by third parties, either now or in the future, that kids or parents may have no awareness of or control over. So a concrete example there would be the data broker industry. So data brokers are commercial entities. They're similar to credit bureaus, but occupy a slightly different niche. So the credit bureau is collecting information about our payment history on our mortgages, our cars, our credit cards, and keeping track of that and giving us a score. Data brokers collect a much larger set of information from a much larger range of sources. They are not nearly as well regulated by law, so they operate in a very shadowy space. Recent study by CLIP, the Center for Law and Information Policy at Fordham Law School, found that data brokers were collecting private information about kids as young as 2 years old, using it to market to those kids and families, sometimes in very invasive ways. So the American Red Cross, through that study, confessed that it had marketed to a young person as a potential blood donor based on health information that it had acquired about that young person. American Red Cross is a wonderful organization. It's great for them to try to find blood donors. It is creepy for them to try to find blood donors through private information about kids that has been aggregated by data brokers and sold to them.
Now, you mentioned that data brokers are not regulated in the same way that the credit reporting agencies are. Isn't that really the conversation we ought to be having, Leah, that data brokers ought to be regulated, not that each of us individually has to learn as much as we can about the digital world and then make decisions about what to share and what not to share?
Yes, we should be having that conversation, and we need to keep having the one about our own choices. We absolutely need our state and federal lawmakers and regulators to be even more courageous and forward-thinking than some of them have already been, some of them not so much. And we need, though, to be informing them as moms, dads, parents, grandparents, teachers. We need to have these conversations with each other about the choices we're making in our own lives so that we're aware of the areas where we need collective action through legislation and regulation, because without one conversation, that everyday life choices conversation, we're not in as strong a position to have the other conversation, the legislative and regulatory conversation.
A lot of what you write about, Leah, and a lot of what you think about are the perils of sharenting, but there are pros and cons, correct? And there are good things that come from sharenting for some people.
Absolutely. So if you take a values-based approach to sharenting and you think about the values that you want to have animate your home or your school and your daily life choices, some of the values that frequently come up would be the value of connection or the value of respecting your kids. And there are values-informed ways that sharenting then makes sense. So one example that I think is very important is for a family that may have a child with a chronic illness or a developmental delay. There can be vital forms of connection in terms of receiving information from families in a similar situation, in terms of informing lawmakers, regulators, and other decision makers about the reality of having a child with those types of situations, that without putting information on social media that, yes, may be private, but needs to inform these community and public dialogues, you wouldn't get change happening. So that can be an example of when sharenting can be very positive, which is building community, getting information, and empowering individuals to come together, both to bond with each other, but also to lift up certain issues that might not get seen if it weren't for sharenting.
So if someone has a child with a chronic illness or something like that, and the power of being part of, say, a Facebook group maybe outweighs the disadvantage of digital data collectors knowing that that child has that condition.
That's right. And you put that so well. You are talking about one sort of values-based commitment, right? So the connection and the information from the Facebook group, in this case, maybe outweighing the other values-based commitment to privacy. And absolutely, I think that in the example that you just gave and in countless other examples, there are really principled reasons why we might sharent and have that be beneficial to ourselves and most importantly to our kids.
Leah, I have to confess, as I was reading your book, I was thinking, you know, I'm on social media, but not real active. But my favorite part of social media is seeing other people's pictures.
I love seeing baby pictures.
I love seeing prom photos and wedding photos and things like that. And I really hope that the scary part of social media does not sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater and get rid of all the things that are so wonderful about, especially being able to see things for those people you care about but don't live nearby.
Well, as long as we're not posting pictures of the baby in the bathwater, I think I'm okay with it. But all joking aside, I agree with you. And so what I would love to see, we see tech companies starting to make more and more ostensibly child-friendly versions of products, right? So you have YouTube Kids, although they've gotten in some significant regulatory trouble. And that's just an example. But what I would would love to see is tech companies stepping up and saying, we will make parent-friendly, privacy-protecting versions of social media or other products, and actually give us, as consumers, products that would do things like not aggregate or share or act upon any information related to kids. Products that would have an auto-delete feature. So let's say you post something about your child's temper tantrum that happens when they're three, you forget about it, but it's still lingering out there when your child turns 10. Well, what if the social media service had auto-deleted that for you after a year? There are ways that the tech companies could give us parent-friendly, privacy-protecting versions of their products, and they are not doing it.
Are there any places in the world where it is happening? Is there somewhere that's ahead of us on this?
I am not familiar with any places in the world where tech vendors themselves are giving us these kinds of parent-friendly or parent-proof, I should say, products and services. Maybe if callers know, I'd love to hear. But I certainly would say that there are individual states like California and regions of the world like the European Union that are ahead of us being sort of the, you know, most of the United States in the individual states and the federal laws that are ahead of us in terms of their legal and regulatory landscape around privacy.
I'm thinking about all the ways in which my children's data is out there between medical records, school records, applying for financial aid for college, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm thinking to myself, and we're living in this world where there are these, instances where hackers are making national news. And I'm thinking to myself, is it possibly a little quaint and a little naive to think that by not posting a picture of my kid on social media, I'm protecting them? I mean, hasn't the horse kind of already left the barn?
I think some sheep and cows have gotten out, too. So you're absolutely right. There are so many ways that institutions have our private data, and truly we are going to need to let them have it to function in modern society. But I would say that there's still plenty of room as parents to try to mitigate the extent of the information and also mitigate the risk that a child will personally experience some sort of embarrassment or limitation. So we've talked a lot, and rightly so, about the dangers of hackers getting our children's information, about data brokers or other commercial interests. But there's also a risk of your child is applying for a job and 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and an actual human being comes across that information. Or your child is getting, you know, waiting for you to pick them up after school, and another parent comes over and says, oh, you know, you looked so beautiful in your prom dress, and your child feels embarrassed because they wanted that dress to be a surprise for their prom date, right? So there are actual human interactions that get informed by our sharenting that do put our kids at the risk of either embarrassment or, if not embarrassment, we're depriving them a little bit of their ability as they grow up to have the agency and autonomy to sort of introduce themselves to the world. And last but certainly not least, it's vital that we as parents model good digital citizenship for our kids. We spend a lot of time, rightly so, talking about, you know, the crazy stuff kids are doing these days on social media. They're sexting pictures of each other. They're cyberbullying. They're doing, I'm Gen X, so who knows what they're doing, right? But we wring our hands about this without stopping to think, gosh, they may be taking pictures of one another and posting without asking for consent because they've had our little flash going off in their face from before they were old enough to realize it. So there is also a modeling value, too, in limiting what we post about our kids.
All right. Well, we're speaking with Leah Plunkett. Her new book is Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back after a short break.
Listener support brings us Main Calling with help from Portland Ballet's Victorian Nutcracker. Holiday finale performances this weekend at Westbrook PAC. Tickets at porttix.com. And Evergreen Home Performance. dedicated to helping Maine homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine rebates and loans with audits and insulation.
As the impeachment trial moves to the Senate, some vulnerable senators find themselves under a microscope.
Cory Gardner can't win Colorado without Democrats and unaffiliated voters, but he absolutely cannot win Colorado without Republicans. And Republicans here are fiercely loyal to the president.
Next time on Takeaways Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRX.
That's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Every young musician who appears on From the Top is at their own unique moment of artistic development. On this week's show, guest host and concert pianist Oralee Shaham explores that very issue, connecting with the young musicians about what they're grappling with as young artists right now. Join From the Top for these discussions and incredible music this week.
And that's Saturday afternoon at 5 on Maine Public Classical, featuring Maine students. This is the program that was recorded here in Maine, in Portland, last month.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, things to think about before posting or talking about our kids on social media. My guest, Leah Plunkett, author of the new book, Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to the calls, Leah, I just wanted to get back to a little bit of conversation about pictures of babies. Reading what you've written and thinking about what you're saying, not necessarily a horrible thing to say, we welcome our new daughter, Janie, into this world, but maybe don't say Janie Elizabeth Smith, born such and such time, such and such day at such and such hospital.
That is right, because when you are giving the all of those details about full name, date and time of birth, location of birth, those are the types of things that really make children's identities, their social security numbers, prime targets for opening fraudulent credit products. So with all of the unfortunate large-scale data breaches that have involved social security numbers in recent years, including health insurance companies, if you are an identity thief looking to get your hands on a social security number that doesn't yet have legitimate credit products tied to it, you're going to be looking for a kid's social security number because they're the folks who haven't yet applied for that mortgage or taken on a student loan. So if you can get through one of those data breaches or other forms of nefarious activity a social security number and get some of those identifying details and build out a stolen identity profile and obtain credit under that social security number and under that child's name, then that can be a gold mine for you.
And I read recently somebody might say, well, my privacy settings are so that only friends and friends of friends can look at my page. But I read recently that most identity theft of children is by family members.
That's correct. And similarly, most abuse and neglect of children is by family members or people kind of in the child's orbit. So you're absolutely right that the privacy settings won't protect you from the dangers within your own network, which are very high. Also, they don't protect you from somebody who might take a screenshot of what you've posted and reshare it. Or maybe they don't reshare it, but maybe they take a screenshot of it for some reason and their phone is hacked or their, you know, iPhoto collection is breached. So if it is digital, it is not private.
We'll go to Rachel, who's calling from Damariscotta. Hi, Rachel. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm so excited that you guys have this program going on. It may help me solve a mystery. So last summer, my then 3-year-old daughter went fishing for the first time, and I took a video and I posted it on Facebook, and my sister-in-law liked it. And about 15 minutes later, she sent me a screenshot, and it was an advertisement from Starbucks, and it said, "Where will your cup take you?" And it had a still from that video with my daughter with her fish and her thumb up. And I was flabbergasted. I still have the screenshot. And I've asked a number of people to explain how a still from a video I post of my daughter would have shown up in a Starbucks ad, and nobody can explain it. And I throw it out to you or just to share with, you know, some of the listeners, like, how crazy stuff happens.
And Rachel, it sounds like it happened very quickly.
Very quickly. Like I said, within 15 minutes, my sister-in-law texted me this screenshot, and she's like, what is this? And, like, at the bottom, it said that there were, like, you know, a bunch of comments and a bunch of shares and a bunch of views, which is really, like, impossible for, like, you know, 837 shares, like, that quickly. But, you know, my brain just started wondering about algorithms and, like, metadata, and it just kind of blew me away, and I've never been able to shake really how disturbing it was. So...
That is a very,
I don't know how it happened.
That is a very powerful and disturbing story. I'm really sorry it happened, and I really appreciate you sharing with us. See, sharing can be very powerful. I don't pretend to know whatever specific type of advertising and marketing arrangement Facebook might have with Starbucks or any other company. But what I do know is that if you start parsing the fine print on Facebook or any other social media platform, really, about their ability to use images that you share, even under private settings, for a whole range of purposes for their own interests, for their own marketing, for their own advertising, for their own products, that legal language in the privacy policy and terms of use tends to be broad enough that you can drive a truck through it. And so the exact, you know, technical sequence of what made them choose that picture and then put it sort of into that ad, I don't pretend, you know, to know all the details, but I definitely know that when we are putting images out there, even when we legitimately think we're just sharing them with the other sets of eyeballs that belong to the people within the group we've defined in our privacy settings, the social media platforms themselves and the web of companies, of their advertisers, the third parties that support them, app developers, and so on, their eyeballs are often on it too. And this is a really creepy example of how that can happen.
Rachel, thank you so much for calling and sharing that. And it kind of reminds me of the whole other conversation of the people who are putting the cute video of their kid catching a fish intentionally online, hoping that it'll become a viral video and there will be advertisement and they will make money off of it. For example, on YouTube, this is called commercial sharenting, I learned from your book.
Yes, it is. And commercial sharenting refers to those parents who either are monetizing who are trying to monetize their kids' private experiences. So Rachel is trying to keep these wonderful, playful private experiences private. She's just trying to connect to the other people in her network, which, by the way, is what social media promises us the ability to do, especially with privacy settings. But many others are trying to get outside gazes and trying to get clicks and likes and reactions and ultimately advertising support to profit off of their kids' experiences. And I find that whole realm intriguing and also disturbing because it's intriguing because, of course, we all love to connect with other families. You think back to the 1950s era sitcoms, right? You sit down, you watch Leave It to Beaver. It's disturbing because you're talking about kids now inhabiting a space of their home or their playground where they think that they're just going about their business and growing up. And then all of a sudden, there are thousands, or if a commercial sharing is successful, millions of other people deriving some sort of reaction to their home life. And that blurs a lot of boundaries between not just the digital and the IRL in real life, but between when kids are just in their home and when kids are actually working.
We've got an email here. What about making privacy the default across all devices? Non-tracking, non-listening, non-recording the default. Many users don't know they're being verbally recorded on social media and all calls and dictated messaging, especially Apple devices. These are listening devices they've paid for. Maybe legislation so people who don't mind losing privacy have to choose to relinquish constitutionally protected privacy tracking and recording. So turning it around that privacy is the default, and if you want to share, you have to do that.
You have to opt in affirmatively and give consent. So a couple of reflections on that wonderful proposal. The first is that moving to affirmative consent and opt in would help. But technically, a lot of these products are already doing this based on consent, right? But the problem is the consent is not meaningful. It might be legal, but it's not meaningful because, especially for something like a watch, good luck finding the privacy policies and terms of use on that watch. They don't print it right on the watch if it's a smartwatch. They probably print it on an insert that goes into the package that you probably lose and the print is really tiny. Or they print it on the website when you go to sync the watch with the web program. And if you can even find all the privacy policies and terms of use, you probably won't be able to understand them. And I don't mean that in a judgmental way. They're written so as not to be able to be understood. So what we would need to do to have a meaningful opt-in and consent basis would be to have stronger legislation and also better enforcement of existing regulations around consumer interactions, because technically a lot of this is happening already because of opt-in. And I'll also flag the email used the word constitutionally protected. We have constitutionally protected rights to privacy in this country under our federal constitution, typically under state constitutions as well. But the Constitution does not apply to private companies unless they're acting on behalf of the state. So our privacy interest against the state of Maine, for instance, would be different from a legal standpoint than our privacy interest against Apple, even if we experience it the same way.
We'll go to Gary, who's calling from Hollowell. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think this is an important topic. And hopefully people kind of pass it on. I think the demographic is probably a little bit older, but I wonder if we're not even just approaching this a little too softly, that maybe instead of trying to find ways to do things a little bit better on social media, that really should be doing things much, much less, that these concerns are already way ahead of us, and that just doing little things different here and there isn't quite enough. I'd be interested to see what your guest thinks about that.
I agree with you. I think that there are ways that our daily choices can be very powerful, but that needs to be happening simultaneously as a part of other tools in a toolkit. I would love to see us have comprehensive federal legislation get passed that is specifically on children's digital data privacy. And one of the things I would want to see on it would be a prohibition without the explicit consent of the parent and probably the child too over a certain age of using private information about kids to make digitally driven major life decisions. So I'd like to try to avoid, we were talking earlier about the horses out of the barn, the cows out of the barn, the sheep are out of the barn. And that's all true. But for a lot of the kids who are going to be hardest hit by it, they're still really young. So there's still time to get a new federal law in place that would say, okay, employer, 10 years from now, you are legally prohibited from using a data-driven, artificial intelligence-enabled way of determining whether a candidate will be a good fit for a job or not based on data that might have been generated about them when they were 2 years old, unless they or their parents, depending on their age, have affirmatively opted in. So I guess this is a way of saying it may be too late to do things with the data that is already out there in a lot of our practices, but we can try to mitigate some of the downstream uses.
All right. So you foresee a time in the not so far away future in which entire profiles are created that potential employers and others would be able to buy based on someone's digital footprint.
Yes. And there's a great book called Weapons of Math Destruction that does a deep dive into all the ways that algorithmically generated predictions and observations are already being used to make decisions about people, particularly people who might be lower income or otherwise vulnerable, in ways that are opaque to the people whose lives are being acted upon. That book tells us, for instance, that the hiring industry, that industry that exists to support employers making job decisions, as of 2016, was a $500 million industry, $500 million, and 60 to 70% of job applicants were already taking digitally driven tests around personality and fit. It is not a big leap for those tests to start on a huge scale, trying to integrate in information about an applicant's past that absolutely could sweep up data that is generated about them and by them going back to, gosh, even before birth. Think about fertility tracking bracelets and apps.
Well, we do need to take another quick break. We're speaking with Leah Plunkett about your children's digital footprint and how you might be able to protect it. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Ocean View at Falmouth, announcing Cumberland Crossing, its new sister retirement community in Cumberland, CumberlandCrossingRC.com, and Maine College of Art, now accepting applications for the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies for Spring 2020, meca.edu/MPR.
It was a Sunday morning when Carrie Duarte found his sister unresponsive. Then EMTs arrived and inserted a breathing tube.
When I seen her on the stretcher, I noticed that her belly looked like it was inflated.
On Next, from the New England News Collaborative, a troubling trend among some first responders in Rhode Island, incorrectly administering breathing tubes and killing patients. Plus, why more people are choosing to be child-free. Please join us.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
It's a holiday tradition for public radio, a solstice celebration featuring the Paul Winter Consort from the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, with special guests Procol Harum's Gary Brooker, gospel singer Teresa Thomason, and Brazil's Fabiana Cosa and Renato Braz. I'm John Schaefer. Join us for the Return of the Sun, the Paul Winter Consort Winter Solstice Celebration from NPR Music.
And that's coming up tomorrow evening from 8 to 10 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, I am speaking with Leah Plunkett, author of the book Sharenthood: Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Marfine, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Marfine. Go ahead.
Hi. Two things. So the first one, facial recognition. A lot of...
Marfine, are you on a speakerphone? It's hard to hear you.
No.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Better.
Parents with facial recognition, they're letting their kids use the phones and iPads. And they're playing all these games. So I'm wondering, has there been any updates on how facial recognition is used in terms of how they're data mining possibly children's faces and reactions? And then the second thing was, is this a generational thing with millennials starting to have kids and being notorious overshares?
Yeah, Marfine, thanks for this. Good questions. Let's start by talking about facial recognition technology, because this is not just on social media, is it? It's becoming everywhere in our lives.
It is. And the New York Times had a great article, may have even been front page news earlier this fall, with the headline, "How Photos of Your Kids Are Powering Surveillance Technology." And the article asked a rhetorical question, but one that I actually take seriously. It said, who could have possibly predicted that a snapshot of a toddler in 2005, this is posted on social media by a parent, would contribute a decade and a half later to the development of bleeding-edge surveillance technology? And my answer to that is, while I didn't write this book in 2005, I wrote it over the last few years, this book absolutely predicts that this type of behavior, where you have, back in 2005, parents posting snapshots of kids and toddlers and infants that are then getting extracted from the social media platforms by third-party developers of facial recognition, and without the parents' knowledge or meaningful consent, being used to train that facial recognition, we should be assuming that the next frontier of that is happening now. And we don't necessarily know, because a lot of these products are being developed by the private sector, which has a financial interest in kind of getting out ahead, what is being done now that is the equivalent of mining photos from social media posts to train facial recognition technology.
Marfine, I've already forgotten your second question. If you could repeat, you remember?
I do. Aaliyah? It has to do with generational attitudes. Yes. And I love that question because I guess I'm going to share a little bit about myself. I'm right at the tail end of Gen X. So right in that, you know, I went to college without a cell phone, but I did have email type of space. And I think that there actually can be a fair amount of sophistication and curation of online identities by the slightly younger generations, and I'm a Gen Xer, than there can be among Gen Xers and up. So actually, one of the things that I've been hearing as I've gone around the country and had conversations with folks everywhere from local libraries to kind of big academic gatherings is, you know, I feel like my own habits are okay, but maybe someone else in my family, and often that someone else is actually older, it's actually a baby boomer, may be oversharing about my child because this person didn't grow up with even the Gen X exposure to digital technology.
Marfine, thanks for your question. We have an email from Travis. I wonder if the false sense of urgency we get from social media clouds our judgment as to what to share. Sounds like it borders on unintentional child abuse. Have there been any lawsuits yet between adult children and parents in Maine?
I am not aware of any in Maine, but I say that without having done the kind of exhaustive deep dive into Maine case law that I would need to do to give that 100%. But I can certainly say that as I have been monitoring nationally the number of lawsuits of kids against parents, you're not seeing them in any significant number at all. But what we are seeing is isolated but still high-profile cases of parents crossing the line into abuse or neglect and the justice system stepping in real time. So an example that was big news a few years back was the YouTube family called Daddy05. And Daddy05 was ostensibly a prank channel where the parents would trick the kids and film it and put it online. And they had, I think, roughly 500,000, maybe over, viewers before they took their channel down. They took their channel down because their pranks with one child in particular crossed the line into abuse and neglect terrain, and viewers alerted the appropriate state child welfare authority, who intervened. So we are seeing instances where tragically parents do cross that line. And I think, you know, the initial prompt of the question of social media creates a sense of, you know, got to get this information out, got to get the endorphin rush from the likes. Does it cloud our judgment and make us share things about our kids? Like, we're doing it for the likes, right? I think that there's something to that. But I do think, mercifully, you are not going to see social media itself kind of urging parents or shaping parents to do things that cross the line legally into abuse and neglect. I would say, and I'm not a psychologist, but I will posit that the folks who are abusing or neglecting their kids and then sharenting it are tragically probably going to be folks who might have been at risk for that anyway. But the social media magnifies it.
We'll go to Rob, who's calling from Wyndham. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for covering this topic. I wanted to go back to your interest in federal legislation and wondering if, you know, that's such a heavy lift to get that done, and taking an approach where, you know, I know that California is working on some very strict privacy guidelines right now. And because it's the internet and it's really difficult, if you want to do business anywhere, California, you'd want to be there. If you have certain requirements, that naturally extends out to the entire internet. And GDPR, which is the European Union's privacy policy, which was enacted a couple of years back, if anyone even passes through Europe and signs up for a newsletter, the law applies to them whether they live there or not, if they ever signed up in the boundaries of the EU. So it might be a strategy to get something done where you take it as, you know, one state could have a pretty major impact in the shift on the larger, you know, privacy controls.
Rob, thanks for your call.
You are absolutely right. And the states have long been very powerful laboratories when it comes to law reform. And California is probably the most powerful of them all in certain ways, especially with respect to the internet. The California Consumer Privacy Act will go into effect very soon, January 1st, 2020. And when, with respect to minors, there is an outright prohibition in that law on the sale of personal information for kids under 17. For kids under 13, there'd have to be an affirmative opt-in by the parents. For kids between 13 and 16, they themselves would need to opt in. So I do think that we are going to see, especially as California rolls out, some really positive and generative new developments in the legal landscape. I do think that when you have something that is incubated by a state and sort of rippling out, even for a state as powerful as California, there can be a real disconnect between laws on the books and enforcement of those laws. And so that's where having comprehensive federal legislation can come in handy. It can often be from an enforcement perspective, with the reach of the federal government, if they are well-funded and act in a responsible manner, which does not always happen.
Rob, thanks for your call. An email from Jessica. My family lives in another state, and we have used and loved an app called Tiny Beans with both of our children since they were born. It's secure, and we can share photos, videos, and milestones all within our selected group of friends and families. TinyBeans.com. Thanks for the program. It's such an important issue. I've never heard of this. Are you familiar with it, Leah?
I have, yes. And interestingly, so I signed up for Tiny Beans because a dear friend was using it to share information about their child. And I agree. I think that it actually does fall into that category of more privacy protecting, kind of parent proof digital service. But what I'm about to say is a general reflection. It's not about Tiny Beans specifically because I have not looked at their terms of use or privacy policies. But there are layers to this. So even a product that is locking down privacy more, until you really read all of the fine print, there can then be questions about, are they extracting any information for sort of the cross sale of products? And so now I will go back from my general question, it's my general law professor question, and say specifically about Tiny Beans, because I have signed up for them. I frequently get promotional emails from them for things like, have you thought about life insurance? Right. And so I don't know if that is like purely they're casting about as a broad solicitation, or if they are still looking at their users' data in some way that would then make them do outreach around those kinds of products. That's a question I truly don't know, but I am familiar with the product.
Mm. We're having this conversation as people are buying gifts. There are gifts that you would like to warn parents not to buy.
Stay away from spyware. I think that the more...
Okay, of course nobody's going to go to the store and buy spyware, Leah. What do you mean by that?
Well, I guess you might if your kid was into James Bond, right? What I mean, Jennifer, would be surveillance products. So when you are thinking about getting your child a smartwatch, right? A watch that can help monitor their movements. And tell you perhaps if that child is going out of a designated area. I really worry about those products. That is spyware. That is enabling you as a parent to know where your child is. And while we certainly have a legal right as parents to do that and an obligation to keep our kids safe, we're also then letting that information be aggregated by a company, which can make it vulnerable, to hacking or unauthorized use. It does also give information to a company about where our kids are going, when they might be outside the limits of where we want them to be. And I do have questions about whether, as a parent, the best way to sort of gauge where your child is in the world and ensure their safety is to serve up information about their movements to a digital tech provider.
What about interactive toys, dolls, games?
The smart toys, right? The smart teddy bear and all of that. I am old-fashioned about this. I think particularly for really young kids, just get them a teddy bear where they can use their imagination. Because when you are talking about a smart teddy bear or a smart toy, that is digitally collecting and transmitting information. And I don't see there being a big value in a spyware teddy bear in terms of giving your child the benefits of playing in the holiday season and beyond.
So much more to talk about, but I made the mistake of looking at the clock. I know we're out of time. Leah Plunkett, thank you so much for being here. Leah Plunkett, a professor at the University of New Hampshire Law School and the author of the new book, Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Our theme is composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Maine Calling is on Maine Public Radio.